Our scripture this morning is carrying on in John, and the next passage is the passage about Jesus washing the disciples' feet, and I sent you out a recommendation that you read Luke 7 and John 12 and then John 13 so that you have a sense of the context of what the folks in this narrative were used to or would be thinking about or would be remembering. I'm not going to read everything in this passage. I'm going to read the part that takes the narrative forward. Just before Passover feast, Jesus knew that his time had come to leave this world to go to the Father. Having loved his dear companions, he continued to love them right to the end. Jesus knew that the Father had put him in complete charge of everything, that he came from God and was on his way back to God. So he got up from the supper table, set aside his robe, and put on an apron. And after he had finished washing... And he washed their feet. He poured the water into the basin and began to wash the feet of the disciples, drying them with the apron. And when he had finished washing their feet, he took the robe, put it back on, and went back to his place at the table. Then he said, "Do you understand what I have done to you? You address me as teacher and master, and rightfully so. That is what I am. So if I, the master and the teacher, washed your feet, you must now wash each other's feet. I've laid down a pattern for you. What I've done, you do. I'm only pointing out the obvious. A servant is not ranked above the master. An employee does not give orders to the employer. If you understand what I'm telling you, act like it and live a blessed life." Now, washing the feet was a regular, everyday occurrence in biblical times. And you've heard a zillion messages about this, so I don't really have to belabor it. But people wore sandals. By and large, it was hot. The roads and the areas were dusty. And so it was customary that when you entered a household, the servant would wash your feet and dry them. And so this was as regular as eating. It was not unusual to have your feet washed as it has been with us. It was a mark of hospitality. And if you did read your Luke passage, when you went to a person's house, there were several things that you could expect. If you came to our house in the winter, you would expect that I would greet you at the door, that I would take your coat and hang it on or hang it up or throw it on the bed in one case or another, and that I would welcome you and invite you to sit. Well, if you were in biblical times and you came to the door, it would be expected that you would be greeted with a kiss, that the servant of the household would come and wash your feet, and that it was a special meal, or if this was a house of means, that they would actually do a little spa treatment. A little oil on that cracked feet, or some perfume, that you know how good a foot rub feels. You could expect a little TLC if this was a special occasion or if this was a household that could afford such a thing. And then if you were a guest of honor, you would probably be given a robe for the occasion. And then you would be invited to the dinner to the feast. Now, there are three narratives which take this normal, perfunctory task and transform it into a profound expression of love. And those three are the Luke passage first, which is a story about the town harlot, as the Message Bible translates that. We don't know why she was so effusive in her gratefulness and her love. We can guess. We can guess that Jesus probably treated her with respect when nobody else did. We could guess that he might have even had a regular conversation with her, like he did another unsavory woman at the well. We can only guess, but what we know from the narrative is that there was this huge outpouring of uncontrollable love and gratitude. That he was at a meal with the Pharisees, and she barged the party. She came in. She wept all over his feet. There were so many tears that it washed his feet. And she dried it with her hair. And then she used really expensive perfume and gave him a spa treatment. Now, this was not a welcome gesture to the Pharisees. First of all, she was the wrong kind of woman. He became ritually unclean because he let her touch him. Secondly, I don't think that you have to squint your eyes very much to realize that this was quite a sensual act. This had sexual overtones, and she was a woman well experienced in sexual overtones. How shocking. How inappropriate for polite society. And yet Jesus was not upset at all. And he said, basically, she did all the things that you did not do. You did not greet me with a kiss. You didn't give me water for my feet. You did not tend to any care for my body, for my feet. And she has poured this out upon me. So the act of foot washing was an act of rising from incredible love and gratitude. And we recognize that one. Now the next story is found in John 12, and Lorraine just preached on it. Because this is Mary, the sister of Lazarus, after Lazarus was raised from the dead. And this is about just a few days before this Passover experience, maybe a week. And they had a feast to celebrate that Lazarus was alive and that Jesus had raised him from the dead. Can you imagine what an incredible, incredible celebration that was? And Mary went to Jesus and washed his feet out of love and gratitude. And again, dried it with her hair and spent her whole life insurance money on perfume to anoint his feet. In those days, I mean, she might have spent her 401k, because in those days, any retirement, anything you had, was put into perfumes, myrrh, frankincense. That's why those were so brought to Jesus. Gold, if you had it. And people wore the gold, because there wasn't a safe deposit box or a bank to put your money in. So she literally spent her future on a holy spa treatment of an hour. No wonder Judas said, "What a waste. What a waste. You could have given that to the poor." Yeah. And Jesus, "Oh, no. No, this was appropriate. This is appropriate." Now, when we get to the Jesus washing the disciples' feet, I'll have to admit that I've always been so rushing ahead to the servant leadership model and to the whole thing that we are supposed to be servants, that I never really noticed before that first part of the passage that says, "And Jesus loved them." He loved them all the way to the end. And so this particular passage doesn't have the tone of voice of a teaching moment. It has the tone of voice of a man who knows this may be the last time he is with his beloved companions. He's eating the last dinner they're going to share, the last Seder feast that's going to happen. And he is overcome with tenderness about how much he loves them. And we can assume they're eating this meal in this room that's not at anybody's house that they know. It's just a room that was provided for them by a stranger. We can assume that there were not servants there. So Peter and John had been sent ahead to prepare the meal, to see that there was a meal. But this would not probably be a whole accompaniment of a household servants, like if they had been guests in somebody's house. And so the task of foot washing had not been done. But as Jesus had this upwelling of tenderness and joy and love, he got up from the table and he did the task that was practical, that was usual. And he did this knowing that everything of God was in his hands. He had the ultimate power. He had the ultimate prestige. He had the ultimate status. He had the ultimate of resources. And he put those down and took on the task of a servant. Now, I have more to say about this, but I just want that to rest. The other dynamic that was going on in the room was something that had been going on for quite some time. And we have some passages in other places in the gospel that tell us about this. The disciples are really aware that they are headed into a climactic, pivotal time by coming into Jerusalem this Passover. Jesus knows, at least John ascribes to him as knowing, that he is going to die. The disciples are assuming that this is going to be the cataclysmic moment of Jesus becoming king. of the defeat of the Romans somehow. They don't know how. But Jesus is the Messiah. He is the King. They have been planning all along. Who's going to be Prime Minister? Who's going to be Secretary of State? Who's going to have the office closest to the King? Judas, there are some scholars that believe that even Judas' betrayal was his way to get the show on the road, to precipitate Jesus having to make his move. Because it was inconceivable. They had put their whole life on the line. Everything was resting on the fact that Jesus was going to be the King. And he was going to make his move. So the disciples had been jockeying for position. Who did Jesus love the most? Who was going to be the greatest? How were they going to do this? What position were they going to have? And the room was probably filled with that, as they know that it's coming. It's coming. It's close. So Jesus does this pillar teaching, and this is one of the pillars of the kingdom of God. You cannot follow Jesus and not follow this. That Jesus said and did, those who are going to be great, those who want to lead, those who have power and prestige and privilege, use it to serve. Use it to serve. And he even makes that more emphatic by saying, you call me master and teacher. And that's right, I am. But then he kind of barrels in. If I'm really your master and teacher, take this seriously. You gotta do it. Now, interestingly enough, it's probably counterculture in the whole world. But Americans especially use privilege and power and status and resources to stay safe. We have made a fetish out of staying safe. In fact, just this week with the airplane being stolen, what happened? Suddenly we have all these things about aviation security and aviation security and safety, and we have to make these new procedures and laws because we think nothing of the impulse that what we need to do is stay safe. As individuals, as people, as folks in the political arena. And Jesus says, no. That's not me. Jesus puts no value on staying safe. Jesus says, really, unless you're ready to give it up, unless you're ready to lose your life, you really can't follow me. You got to be ready to give it up. That is not a value that is Jesus' value. And the really sad thing is that a whole bunch of the Christian community is willing to support folks that are bullies and that are cruel and that have no interest in kindness to be bullies on their behalf because they think it'll keep them safe. It'll give them power. It'll make the kind of kingdom they think they want. So Jesus says, this is key if you're going to follow me. Who you are, what you are, your gifts are at the service of those who are I love. Now that's the first piece, I think, that strikes me, is that servanthood rises out of compassion, rises out of love. I think we Americans are really, Christians are really, really short on compassion. I think we have a crisis. We're good at judging. We're good at saying what's right and wrong. But we have a real deficit of looking at a broken world and being compassionate. Patty, I'm thinking about when you encountered that drunk man passed out on the sidewalk who smelled awful. Everybody was passing by, and you were filled with compassion. And you were down there with him in his face. Not because you set out that morning to be a servant, but because your heart broke for him. And you saw something beyond his broken state. Think of the times that you have served. You have served well. Think of the times that you have been there for relatives or friends who are really ill. Think of the things that you have done that you would never want to do. The throw up in your car as you took someone from chemo. The aging parent who's incontinent that you cleaned up. The ways that you reach in servanthood to folks that you love. The first motion is for us to ask for more love. For let our hearts be broken with compassion. And then servanthood will flow pretty naturally. We won't be sitting with big oughts and shoulds and musts. We'll be down where people are. The second thing is that I'm really struck with how practical the washing of the feet is. That here again, it is the normal, ordinary things that are transformed. And that we enter into the common with compassion to serve and release and lift up. And every time we do that, God's will is done on earth as it is in heaven. Now, the deal with life is that we pass up tons of these moments. I was remembering that Dick and I, when we were first married, our first summer, we had a camping trailer, and we set out from Southern California, and we were going to Jasper. And we had heard that Jasper was really beautiful. And we went through astounding scenery. But we didn't pay too much attention to it because we were on our way to Jasper. When we got to Jasper, it wasn't such much. We had passed way more wonderful things than Jasper. And it was an important life lesson that we had really, not in a big way, but we had squandered everything that was between because we had this goal. This week, there was a reflection in the way of the Spirit that Chris shared with me and had permission to share with me, and I feel liberty to share with you. And that is that in way of the Spirit, there is a delightful, wonderful young mother who has creative wisdom that just floods out of her pores. And she has two little ones. I think the girl is 5. Is that true? And the little girl was really transfixed by bees. And so she asked her mom if her mom would make a plush bee. And her mom said, yeah, I'll do that. Love to do that. And so then the little girl looked at her and said, well, do sewing machines sew? And her mom said, yep. And she said, well, then they shoot out mama's love. And the young mother went, wow. She understands that out of the common thing, sewing a plush toy, that God's love shoots out. Now, we know this because of Stone Soup Quilts. We know that making quilts out of compassion and servanthood shoots out love all over. And the mom commented, I want to read this just to get it right because it was so excellently put. She said, there is a way of making a bee snugly that's a response to a request for goods or services. But my daughter sees it for what it is, the transmission of love. Now, this is the coolest thing. Because in this, all the common things we do every day are an opportunity to shoot out love. We don't have to pass them by. We can just be mindful. We can just stop with and think about whatever the thing we're doing right this minute and move it into compassion. And do that in the service of love, in the service of whatever the person needs, wants, is thirsty for. That is pretty exciting. The third point is one that I think we have to wrestle with, and that is the truth of the matter is, though we call ourselves Christians, though we say we follow Jesus, though we say we love Jesus, we often don't believe him. We really don't believe that love overcomes evil, or we would act differently. We really don't think that leadership comes through servanthood, or we would act differently. We really don't believe that God is our provision and that we do not have to be self-saving to be safe. And this is a challenge for all of us to begin to, bit by bit, step by step, situation by situation, move our inner being to believing what Jesus says. Believing it so we're not always split. So that it's not a yes, but. So it's not a yes, I believe that, and I'm going to act totally different over here. That's a long journey for all of us. We're all in that process. But that's what Jesus is calling us to when he says, don't you understand? If you understand, act like it and live a blessed life. I know this has been long. I always preach long. But let's have some time that you can reflect, that you can subtract or add as the Spirit brings it to you.